And welcome back to Rediscovering Liberalism. We are here today with episode 4 of this wonderful podcast, and we have many pretty good topics to discuss today. We're coming fresh off, let's see, in the recent news, I would say there's a whole lot of COVID. President Trump has gotten COVID since the last podcast and seemingly recovered from that. I don't know if we wanted to discuss that, but certainly like the drugs that he was administered seemed effective. And then, let's see, Amy Coney Barrett has I think October 22nd is her confirmation, her committee vote, I believe, set by Lindsey Graham. And then I think we're going to be deep diving a little bit into, like, the tenets of, like, how the Senate operates, kind of some structural reforms, questions about that this podcast. So very exciting topics. And I think, Jacob, I think you're kind of, like, leading the discussion in some areas, but it's also certainly bouncing ideas off. Why don't you take it away? What are we talking about?
Well, should we start with the filibuster?
Great place, I think.
That's definitely one you hear about a lot. So just to fill everyone in case you haven't been paying attention, there's been a lot of talk recently. If the Democrats take the Senate and Joe Biden wins, there's been talk of potentially removing the filibuster. And just a quick definition of the filibuster just basically means that for most legislation to pass, the Senate needs like 60 votes instead of a simple 51 vote majority. So this is a Senate rule. It's not in the Constitution, but it's been around for quite a while. And it's definitely been used a lot lately by both parties to sort of obstruct whatever party's in power. There's been discussion. People seem to be pretty opinionated about it. My personal opinion, just to start off, I guess, I would be okay seeing the filibuster taken away. I don't really think it's that useful. I think it's interesting and kind of telling that the Founding Fathers didn't put that sort of a requirement in the Constitution. They said when they, you know, set up the Constitution, talking about the Senate, they were totally okay with just a simple majority moving things through, which I think is kind of interesting that we've then since added on this extra requirement after the fact. To me, I'm generally more of like a majoritarian kind of ideology. I think that if a certain party has a more popular opinion in general, like, I think that that should be the way the country moves. And obviously, yeah, like, you need to have, like, it shouldn't be unlimited power. Like, we have a system based on checks and balances. But I think the filibuster too often is essentially a tool for minority control, minority power, at the expense of, you know, popular opinions and decisions. So any thoughts by you guys? You want to say where you stand or your opinions on it?
I would say for me, I guess I find myself more and more, and we've talked about this, I think, or at least expanded on it a bit. The traditionalist in me is not lost quite yet. And I think that when I say that, I would defer, of course, it was not in the Constitution. I would also like posit maybe that it wasn't even really meant for like a popular vote Senate. And we've had this conversation before too. I think the filibuster did originate before the Senate was elected by we the people. It was they were elected rather by, you know, your state representatives, state senators, and state or House. I can't remember quite exactly how the structure worked, but it was all through your local legislature. And so, again, I think like measuring, we're almost comparing like apples and oranges here when we're talking about the things that existed. And again, I also will say like the Senate was known to be like the greatest, you know, deliberative body in the entire world. And I think that was not because we had such grand ideas. It seems like we certainly wrestled with slavery a lot longer than people have, racism a lot longer than other countries have. I don't know if it was like, you know, decorum or what it is, but like, I would certainly also say that I think that one of the greatest contributing factors to the Senate's like grand opinion or popular notion of how it acted and how it proceeded, I think a lot of that came from the fact that it struck a very good balance between you know, you use the phrase minority power, and that's certainly like a way to convey it. But also on the other hand, when you are the minority, or your ideology is the minority, I think it's very, very good and very, I think it's a necessary, maybe it's a necessary evil, but I'd say in my mind, it's a necessary protection. Not the filibuster necessarily, but again, please remember, I'm talking about like the in a grander sense, minority protections, in that it, no big sweeping change can occur without like deliberative thought. Now, again, please also understand, I'm not describing what is right now. That I'm not like, this is not, maybe this is what ought to be, I guess, in my perfect sense of the Senate. But so I guess to end my little rant here on the filibuster note, I think that the question I would maybe have for you is, do you see any, like, again, if let's say you have 4 to 8 years of a Democratic presidency and then it swings wildly back to the right again for any which reason, like for the general population, let's say a general, I think America is becoming a bit more liberal. Like I think we're the conservative side, not necessarily the whole ideology is winning over, but I think like in general, some issues are, the needle is moving a little bit to the left. And when I say that, I think that the Senate needs to reflect it. And I'd say how it's currently operating with like the, what is it? The stats are the Democrats need to win 3 to 6% more or something like that to win a seat. It is. It protects small states. And again, I think it's just your perspective, right? If you're sitting in a New York City loft, I think it's definitely a different perspective when a Donald Trump wins, because the Bible Belt, or the, what do they lovingly call us? The flyover states. That flyover country tells them who their president is going to be. And that rift, I think, will happen just as strongly. That will, the pendulum's going to swing back for, you know, some, let's say, unendeared Republicans in flyover country when I think Joe Biden's going to win in a couple weeks. You know what I mean? So what do you think? What do you think about like minority protection versus minority power? Do you see any perspective, like, again, maybe for the smaller states when it was originally drafted, when the Senate was originally written, you know, created, it was something that was more divorced from, you didn't have to answer to like the people directly, which I think definitely brought down a little bit of the temperature. And that also allowed the filibuster, I think, to flourish rather than be used as a political weapon. This is what stinks. Like, we used, like, decorum kind of seems like thrown out the window for political expediency now. You know what I mean? And that goes for both parties. So, again, minority protection versus minority power. Is there any, like, love lost with you in terms of, like, the traditionalist sense? Or what do you have to say to that? Do you see any big things changing as a result? What are your big, and can you give me like a positive and a negative, or all positives, all negatives, whatever you're thinking? What is the result of the removing the filibuster?
So I guess with like the, yeah, I think you said a very common like argument for the filibuster where, yeah, you want to have the minority party be involved. And I think the idea is that, oh, if there's a filibuster, you need to get bipartisan legislation most of the time. Like one party can't just force something through, and you need to work with both sides, which is a nice notion. But if you look at the effect of that, like, I mean, just look at what we have now. I mean, do we see bipartisanship? Not really. I mean, the last, 10 years, there's been virtually none I can remember. I mean, on big things, it's a lot of partisan things one way or the other. So, I mean, in that sense, like, if its goal is to promote, like, compromise and, like, moderate opinions, it doesn't really seem to be working, to me at least. And essentially, because it just gives the minority party like a full-on veto. You know, it's not like they need to like convince the other side to like go more moderate. They can just say no and it won't happen. You know, so like I almost think a benefit of getting rid of it, I think you might actually see more minority party getting involved, because right now, if you have, say, the Democrats and the minority and the Republicans, the majority, like it is right now, if the Republicans want to pass something, I mean, I guess obviously the House is Democrats, so that's a bad example, but pretend we're a couple years ago when the Republicans had the House. If they wanted to pass something, like, and the Democrats wanted to block it, there's not, like, they would just block it. And vice versa, if Joe Biden's president and the Republicans keep the Senate, like, and he wants to do healthcare reform, they're probably just going to say no and not do anything. Whereas if it was just a straight majority vote and the party in power would have the majority, so then it would almost be more of an incentive for the minority party to say, look, you can come to the table and negotiate in good faith And, you know, we can try to find a bipartisan agreement just because, you know, we think that's what's good for the country. But if you're going to play hardball and just not actually give us any legitimate compromises, just say no to everything, just play obstructionist, then we're just going to push it through. It's almost just like, you know, it gives the power back to like the majority. But I think like the point of a democracy is that a majority like should be in charge, I guess, is like the fundamental principle. So like, I mean, they can work together, but ultimately if a party is being too obstructionist, if you don't have a filibuster, the majority party can say, like, they can try to negotiate, but if they don't, like, they have that threat to just be like, you can negotiate with us and we'll consider it, but if you're going to, like, just say no to everything, then we'll just do what we want without you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, wouldn't it be just as naive, though, to say that, like, you know, if we kept the filibuster on my side, right, wouldn't it be, or on the side perhaps that I'm playing devil's advocate for, undecided, mark me so far, but, like, on one side, right, there's the weird assumption that, oh, the filibuster is only going to be used in extreme situations or in good faith. And like, those seem to be laughable propositions in recent time.
Yeah.
But also, isn't it just as naive to say that like, then the majority party won't just every single time either assume that the other party has no desire to compromise, so they're just going to ram things through? Or like, aren't there naive assumptions on both sides that maybe ask the question like, well, is there a compromise in the middle? Like, where, because it really does seem like, imagine, my friend, imagine getting like a Donald Trump-esque legislative majority. Well, if all the power is rested in the legislature, you know what I mean? If you don't have the restraints that you do on the executive, or that we thought we did before we had Trump, like if there's a Trump-esque, you know, like a, let's say like the, in Poland, I believe it's the Peace Party. And it's just like it's a very, very like right-wing, nationalistic, almost like white, I won't say supremacy, again, I'm not super educated on the topic, but it does lean that way, right? So that's what I'd be worried about. You get a majority that's, there's no possible checks, and you have to wait 2 years to do something about it. And I'm not saying, again, I'm in my own mind, I hope you realize my own arguments, shortcomings are pretty evident to me. Like I said, there is naivete in saying that good faith will be the only time filibusters are used. Of course it'll be weaponized. I just wonder why it worked, or why it seemed to last. It seemed to last for 150 years, or maybe I'm wrong on that date, but it seems to be in the 1800s, right? So like, let's say safely 100 years, right, of structurally good use of it or something, right? I don't understand. How has this not been a more recent conversation? And my mind immediately goes to, if I may say, the media. Again, I don't want to point the blame at them constantly, because I don't think it's always their fault, but like, it does seem to be a problem of like temperature. It seems like we're all angry all the time, and everything is done out of spite. And that seems to be a more biting issue than like, do you know what I mean? Because then, I mean, look, it's almost like martyrdom syndrome, right? Like where if you have, you're going to have people even more extreme on the right and more extreme on the left produced by just ramming things through. There's almost like no good answer. It seems like we almost get produced. One can imagine a situation where it's paths up the exact same mountain where we're right at the beginning. Like, do you understand what I'm saying? Where like, again, the minority feels constantly scorned for 2 years. We ratchet each other up and then we go take the house again and we wait until our party cycles. We just looked it up last night, I think it was, Josh. The Senate in 2022 is a majority. Again, most Republicans are up. It's like 22 Republicans and 12 Democrats. It's a huge, like, again, if you're saying Republicans have no good platform to change the way they look now and Biden is going to sweep, isn't it another bloodbath, hypothetically, in 2022 for them? So all I'm saying is, and then imagine how scorned they come back in 2024 or something like that. Again, it just seems like there might be more pressing issues than the filibuster. And I'm also saying, we had an argument, or like we had a discussion about this, Jacob, you know, off the podcast, and it came to like political expediency, right? Like I was talking about repealing the 17th Amendment, which is the amendment that, if I may allude to what I was talking to earlier, that's where senators were elected by the state legislatures. The 17th Amendment made it so that now, as the current reigning philosophy is, we popular vote or popularly elect senators. And again, I think there's a better argument there with like the Electoral College, like popularly electing the president versus taking away something like in the filibuster or in the Senate. And again, please don't mark me as like decided against taking it away. I see the fallibility of both sides.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, I mean, like you were mentioned Poland and what's going on there, and I think a similar thing is going on in like Hungary in Europe, where you kind of get, you kind of get one party that starts to kind of dominate and then push through some anti-democratic type reforms. And yeah, that's, can be a dangerous spiral.
Also, the judiciary is a very, like, I think we all underestimate, and I'm guilty of this too, an independent judiciary of any, like, strings to any of the other branches, especially at the top dog, like, that is incredibly important. Like, Chief Justice Roberts was not wrong in that, like, calling out the, there's no Obama justices, Trump, like, hopefully we can all be, and that's another thing, that's where Republicans, I think, are guilty, where it's like, you ratchet up the temperature with the only other legitimate branch of government, you're going to kiss this republic goodbye. Like, if you, we're at, like, and again, I do, I think the media bears a whole ton of responsibility. I think Trump, like, I voted for him. And I, like, I do, I think, like, I have some reforming myself, or, like, making sure I pay for that sin, because it was a terrible one. And, like, yeah, anyways, the sum of all my argument is the filibuster specifically. I think, I definitely think it's a reform worth talking about. And I'm still curious to have the conversation tonight, but again, it does. It strikes me as, like, I'd just be worried about, I can see so easily, again, the minority feeling scorned. And again, the peace party, I'm not sure what Hungary, but I'm not surprised in the slightest. Like, Eastern Europe seems to struggle with that, where it's like, yeah, Poland, Hungary, I don't, is Austria, is that still a country?
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Anyways, we're definitely not European experts here, but yeah, no, it is. It's weird how that works. And I do worry about, like, flyover country. We do have aspects of that. Like, let's not be the Proud Boys and, like, the Boogaloo movement. Have you heard of that whole thing? Like, all of that is very, like, real, very palpable, especially in the face of this, like, Governor Whitmer out of Michigan, like the kidnapping plot that was just foiled. And then we heard Governor Northam of Virginia, I believe, was also on that list. So, I mean, like, these things are, like, real and they're here.
There's thousands of them.
Exactly. And so if you, like, that's what I'm saying. If you, let's be practical and let's be politically like, expedient minded, if you will. And, like, we're looking at a Republican minority for at least 4 years, I would say. Let's say 2 years, and I think that's a lot more predictable, like a predictable result. A 2-year gap right now, I would not ratchet up the temperature. And again, I'm not saying Democrats need to constantly take kicking to the throat. That's not what I'm saying. They should. Like, I think we talked in, like, our little group chat or whatever about the packing the court. Like, if they have the power to do it, Mitch McConnell, it's kind of time to, like, swallow your own medicine almost. Like, you stood by and let this happen. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. It's just every single thing, even taking away the filibuster does, it just seems like it's a cycle. It just ups it a little bit. I'm not saying it's not a solution. It just seems like, gosh, I see how it could go wrong, especially in a pragmatic sense of a Republican minority.
So, I would say some notable differences with the U.S. versus some of these other countries. We have a lot of, like, if you look at, say, a more, like, parliamentarian type government where, like, the legislature has a ton of power, you know, then it's like there's fewer checks on what they can do. But our system, the way it's set up, I mean, we have two houses in the legislature that would need to approve. You have a president that would need to approve. And then we have the Supreme Court as ultimate, like, you know, arbiter of whether something is, like, legal or not. So, like, there's a lot of, like, veto points in the system. It's not like, oh, if you take away the filibuster, then the Senate alone can ram through whatever they want. Like, you still need the House of Representatives. You know, you need half of them. You still need the president. You still need the Senate. The courts would still need to say it's constitutional. So I feel like even if you take that protection away, there's so many other checks in the, like, built into the system constitutionally, whereas, like, you know, this is more of an artificial, like, after the fact rule. But I think the founding fathers built in quite a few other checks and balances to kind of, like, you know, limit the legislature from being too, you know, too controlling. And I think I think that in and of itself would do enough to, like, prevent things from swinging too much. And so, like, even if, you know, like you talked about, where things, you know, swing back and forth depending on who's in power. I mean, if we look at, okay, Obama comes in 2008, Democrats have the Senate, House, presidency, and they do, you know, they do some stuff. They pass Obamacare, probably the most famous thing they did. And yeah, that was, you know, very notably, like, the Republicans really did not support that at all, and they campaigned heavily against it, won a bunch of seats in the House in 2010. I think they took the Senate in maybe 2012 or maybe 14, I don't remember exactly, but and they kind of campaigned against it. And from, you know, from there, that after 2010, really Obama couldn't do a whole lot else because the Republicans you know, enough. And obviously, like, the people who elected the Republicans to Congress were kind of wanting to put the brakes on that agenda, which I think is like the natural process, you know, that I think that the founders envisioned, is if something happens that people don't like, then, you know, yeah, 2 years maybe feels like a long time, but in the grand scheme of the history of the country or the government, it's really not that long. You know, the part, like, the individual people elect a party, the opposition party, and they kind of put the brakes. And but then you look, you know, you look, the Republicans end up taking the presidency in 2016, and they have the Senate and they have the House. Now they have the trifecta. And, you know, conventional wisdom would say, oh, well, these people campaigned against Obamacare all these years. They said they were going to repeal it. They said they were going to replace it. And then you look and they don't do that. You know, like, they say they're going to, but then ultimately they don't, like, within their own party, even though they have a majority, they couldn't, you know, there's a few, John McCain and a few others who said, like, no, we're, you know, we're going to keep this Obamacare. So, and part of that, I think, is because it had grown more popular. When it was initially passed, it was quite unpopular, but as it's been rolled out and people, I think, have started to see, you know, some of the benefits of it, they decided it was not going to be in the Republicans' best interest to overturn it. You know, they decided, obviously, those few senators who did. So ultimately, I think that's kind of like, yeah, in theory, maybe you'd get all these swings, but that would only be if the policies themselves end up being super unpopular. Whereas, like, I think the Obamacare is a really interesting case study to show that, like, if it was unpopular, but then over time, people, it just sort of becomes a new normal and people kind of like it. Even some Republicans are willing to accept it now. So I think that in of itself, if you just give it some time for things to actually be implemented and tested out, and then people decide whether they're going to repeal it or not. And, you know, maybe in a different world, maybe it would have gone really poorly and maybe it would have gotten overturned and maybe Republicans could have come up with something better. But, you know, if that, you know, then in a few years, that democratic process would occur and we would see, what does the country want? Do they like this system? Do they not like it? I don't know. I think it just, when you let things pass, then you kind of get the feedback of the constituents can decide whether they like that or whether they don't. And, you know, and I think if you look at, on the other side versus Obamacare, if you look at something the Republicans did, you look at, say, the Bush tax cuts, you know, those, I don't know. I don't think the Democrats, I'm guessing, probably did not support it initially, but then when they were going to set to expire, when Obama was president, they ended up renewing most of them, at least for the middle and lower classes. They raised taxes on the rich a little bit, but because a lot of the middle class tax cuts that Bush had implemented tended to actually be quite popular. People, you know, Democrats even were willing to keep those because they knew it was politically popular. So I think that's sort of like, even partisan things, when they're passed in a partisan way, it may ratchet up the heat temporarily, but once they're passed and people kind of can decide, like, is this good? Is this bad? And they can vote accordingly. It's like, you can then, like, sometimes then people will end up changing their opinions, you know? So they may seem like this is super partisan and inflammatory and we hate this, but then it's like you give it 5, 10, 15 years and then it's just people are okay with it. So I think that's kind of an important thing to keep in mind too. Whereas I don't know if things would swing back and forth as much as we would think they would in a theoretical world. I think the real world's a little different.
Josh, what do you think? Got any thoughts on the filibuster in general or structural reform in the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see the pluses of removing it and then the potential side effects as well. It's I think I would tend to probably lean towards removing it just with the other built-in checks that exist. It'd probably result in more legislation being passed and hopefully some beneficial stuff too.
Yeah, I think I can definitely see the pros of it too. I think that, like, in the Senate in particular, it's in regards to the 2008, like, you know, Obamacare bill, I would say that I think it was like government working well, like the House going Republican in 2010 and then Senate taking two more years. Like, giving the system credit where it's due is important, too. And I think, like, the system that we have does it, when it's not manipulated, like I said, even gerrymandering is another conversation that's, like, needlessly tiring. And, like, I get really sick of the Republican, like the voter suppression claim. Like like voter ID laws and stuff like that, I see the merit to, and then they go a little too far, and then they're like, it's either Trump trying to get specific people off the census and then they don't count, or like new immigrants that don't count for like proportional, or what is it? Like, I just read an article, something about how he doesn't support, like their votes for maybe it is proportional representation on the census or something like that. And it is. So yeah, anyways, the Republican side, I definitely agree with you. I think that like the feedback loop of like policy being produced and then having the ability to go through, it does, like, to be honest with you, I'm not in a huge agreement with like the Green New Deal. I'm not in huge agreement with like coronavirus stimulus aid and like an aid package. I would definitely be like pro on, but a lot of the other things, like imagine like court packing. I don't know how you undo that, like unring that bell when you pat, you know, like, do you just like flip flop, like, hey, from 2020 to 2028, we had 11 justices. And then the next Republican majority removed that. Does that number now become just another thing that's like, and again, please don't, I'm not pegging it just on the Democrats. The blame can't possibly rest on, like, they're viewing it as one of their multiple options to what Republicans are doing. But again, it's just, like I said, yeah, I'm certainly hopeful that like the legislation that they pass, I really like what one of our friends said in another one of our group chats about the 60 votes being like a thing that like we could precondition a lot of this on. Like, that's another thing. Like, as much as I would love to see Barrett on the court, and again, still talking about like the Senate and its reflection on people, or its reflection on the people. Yeah, I would love to see Barrett on the court, but I would even love more to see like Republicans, before they give up every like seat of power that they have in November, like reach out and say, can we get the 60 votes back? We'll remove like a nomination of Barrett, and can we come up with something better? That'd be awesome. And that would even install like integrity in terms of like any electoral issues that happen and stuff like that, I think. And that would probably even swing voters back to like the, it's just like, it seems like an easy thing perhaps to my mind, but.
And now back to the real world.
And now, yeah.
Where things like that don't happen.
Yep. And now back to the real world, where I think Barrett will probably be confirmed less than like a week out from the election.
No, yeah. It'll
be real tight.
To your point, like, I think, like, as I've just been explaining, like, I'm generally against a filibuster for like legislation. For something like the court, like, I think you could make a stronger case for having the filibuster and requiring a supermajority, just because you do want to keep it. Like, the Supreme Court matters because the country views it as a legitimate institution, you know? So like, I could see the argument for saying like, hey, if this is going to be deciding important things, like, it better be like bipartisan, which like as early as like, what, in the 90s, like, people could be confirmed like almost unanimous. I mean, this is a very recent phenomenon. So like, I think like, if you're going to have the filibuster for anything, like, judicial probably makes the most sense. It's like backwards. I think our current system is completely backwards, where we filibuster like things that shouldn't be, but like the really important things like Supreme Court, then like that should be independent and like neutral and nonpartisan, become partisan because we don't have a filibuster.
Do the Democrats use the filibuster? Have they used that? It seems like that's like a Rand Paul, Ted Cruz almost thing.
I think of.
I'm sure they have. I don't know. I haven't heard of. I don't think they've had to recently, just because you have the Senate Republican and the House Democrat. Sure. So when you have the split like legislative, I feel like you don't hear about it as much, just because it is more irrelevant, because you know what I mean? Like, Nancy Pelosi, if he doesn't want it, she's just not going to bring it up in her chamber. But also another weird quirk, though, just kind of to probably start to close out the conversation on the filibuster. Like, are you guys familiar with the budget reconciliation process in the Senate? So it's this weird Senate rule. Basically, it allows, it's like a temporary, it's like a one, I think it's like they can only use like once or twice a year. It's like a very specific law they can use, or procedure they can use, where the Senate can pass certain bills and they can bypass the filibuster. Like, you can't filibuster them. So, but it can only apply to like tax and spending bills. And so it's like this weird loophole where certain laws can be passed without the 60 votes, and but they can only do it like certain times, and it's only related to like tax and spending. So it's like this, I don't know. It's like there already is so many loopholes in the filibusters. Like, obviously, recently, you don't need the supermajority for the Supreme Court. You don't need it for the lower courts, and you don't need it if it's certain. I think that's how the Republicans passed the Trump tax cuts, I believe, because they did not have a supermajority. So if you look at, say, like, Donald Trump, with the tax cuts. Like, I believe that was through the Budget Reconciliation Act, where the Democrats, I don't believe, supported that. I don't think he got any, or at least not to the 60 votes that would have normally been needed for something like that. But because the tax cuts fall under something that's qualified under this loophole called budget reconciliation, they could pass it without a supermajority anyway. So it's like, you know, there's the current system, I think, is just in a lot of ways backwards from what it really should. If we're going to have a filibuster for anything, it should probably be for the courts and not for regular legislation. It's just like a complete 180 of what I think it should be right now. So I guess that's kind of what I have to say on it.
Yeah, I think you've definitely, like, a more convincing argument than what I thought before, I would say. It's a shame it comes to, like, taking away things like that where, again, you could have just used them in, like, a decorum manner, and, like, if it was something that, you know, your party... It just seems like that's just it. Every single issue is, like, a make-or-break issue now, where it's, like, every single one that's put on the news or put in front of any legislative body in America, it's just, like... This is the new thing we're staking our entire, like, political success on, and if we lose, it's inconceivable and we can't do it. So that I don't know how any changes, let alone just the filibuster, will fix that. But I would say that hopefully they're able to find a way to vote thresholds. That was what I was thinking earlier, like a 60 vote threshold, 60, like, supermajority, stuff like that. I think that those are really useful tools too, like, just like structuring maybe like what types of votes need certain, you know, what types, maybe just that kind of clarity where you need this much compromise for these kind of issues, like maybe something like that, where that's enough minority protection, and I think 60 should be as high as you go most of the time. But yeah, for like Supreme Court nominations, I mean, really anything where like the Senate has to give advice and consent, I suppose, which might just be the Senate operation, I suppose. Or, I'm so sorry, the judicial nomination to the Supreme Court for the Senate, rather. But anyways, yeah, maybe those vote thresholds could be raised to like 55 or something like that for, it just, I don't know, I mean, it might sound goofy, maybe it is, but...
I think I heard, actually, now that you mentioned it, I think I heard a proposal, and I don't know who proposed it, but it was something, and I could be misrepresenting it, I'm just going off memory here, but... It was some idea where you start with like a basic like filibuster threshold of like 60 or something like that, and you know the senators can debate, because that's what filibuster, you know, at its core really is a senator can use the floor time and talk and debate and do all that stuff. And there's something that like each day, like the number of like each day that this filibuster carried on, essentially like blocking the vote from occurring, you would like subtract one from the number needed to override it. Because right now, you know, it takes 60, so then, okay, you debate it, they block it. Next day, you only need 59 to override it. The next day, you know, just kind of go down either one at a time, maybe you go a few at a time, but like basically after like, you know, a couple weeks, it would just be a straight like majority. Can you like, so you could kind of preserve, the idea of that would be you could preserve some of the like debate and like, okay, if you want to get this through, like you can ram it through, but like you can't do it instantly. Like you're going to have to wait a few days and like kind of like make our case on the floor of the Senate and like, you know, kind of voice our concerns about it. And if, you know, if after whatever 10 days go by, whatever the magic number would be, then a simple majority can override it, but you still try to preserve some of that like... I mean, you try to preserve the majority power where the majority is the one in control, but you also try to preserve, like, the chance for the minority to be heard and to voice their displeasure with something. So I thought that would maybe be an interesting thing to kind of look into, where you're kind of trying to preserve the spirit of the filibuster without the obstruction that comes with it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea. I actually think that's a, like... Again, it's weird that we have to come up with these kind of solutions, but for sure, I think that one's like a pretty operable one. I don't think that's a bad idea at all.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, I think we can move the discussion on to a topic that I'd kind of like to discuss with you guys. It's a different sort of like structural reform that I think would be good for the United States, and it's called proportional representation. So it's common in like... You know, you look at like Switzerland or Finland or Sweden. A lot of those countries in Europe have it. And basically what it means is the votes are allocated for, say, like a legislative chamber. So like in the U.S., it'd be like the Senate or the House, you know, one of those two or both. And they're allocated not based on who wins majority or a plurality. So like in the U.S., you know, our system is we have an election for, say, a senator, and whoever gets the most votes, even if, say, they only get 48%, the other person gets 47, and then other independents get 5 or whatever, you know, the person who gets the most votes wins straight up. Proportional representation would not have that type of a system. It's basically like the percent of votes cast for any particular candidate or party would get like reflected in the actual like legislative body. So like the way this would play out in like my hypothetical scenario, I'm kind of just working through what this could look like in the US. So I'm just kind of trying to bounce some ideas off and see what we can come up with. But my idea of what it would look like, the Senate, I think would be a good thing to maybe reform. So instead of the current Senate structure where each state gets 2, you just make the whole thing basically proportional representation. So what that would look like, you could have each state, you know, you could probably shorten the terms to 4 years, I think is what you'd have to do to line up with a presidential election or something like that. And you could have everyone vote, and you would vote for like a specific, it would probably be more of like a, it's called a party list is what some countries in Europe do. So instead of voting for like an individual candidate, like we vote for, say, like John Hoeven in North Dakota or whatever that looks like, you know, Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota, instead of voting for a candidate, you vote for a, say, like a political party, and the political parties then would put out like candidate lists of like, these are people who reflect our values, these are people who we would like, you know, they kind of rank like who they would put in. So then you basically vote for like a party of who you want reflect, who reflects your values. And you could vote for, you know, Republican, Democrat, but this would also open up the avenue for third parties. You could vote Green Party, you could vote Libertarian, you could vote, you know, whatever. I mean, there's probably a lot more that could be created with this system. And even if, say, Libertarians, say they get 10% of the vote, well, in our current system, that doesn't do you any good. You're just, you lose and there's a wasted vote. But in this proportional representation system, if you had a Senate with 100 people in it and the Libertarians got 10% of the nationwide, you know, vote under this system, 10 of the senators then could be representing Libertarians, which would then reflect, you know, if 10% of the country's Libertarian, the Senate would be 10%. So it just reflects what people actually believe instead of having to be forced into this, like, oh, what's the lesser of two evils? Like, oh, I hate this party more, so I'm going to vote the other one. You know, it actually lets you express your true beliefs and your true priorities without wasting your vote. And that allows for more than, you know, more than two parties. And that's why you look at, in Europe, they really don't have a lot of this, like, gridlock like we do. In that sense, like, they have, their governments are forced to form coalitions a lot of the time. So where multiple political parties, in order to get over the majority threshold, you know, because no one party usually wins a majority. So they'll have to combine with another party that's ideologically similar to them. So say maybe what that would look like is, you know, the Republicans and Libertarians would form a coalition to accomplish tax reform or something. Or, you know, maybe the Green Party and the Democrats form a coalition to pass some environmental legislation. You know, you sort of have to form coalitions with people outside your party to get things done. And I think that's kind of a interesting thing. I know we were just talking about the filibuster and how we'd maybe like to see more bipartisan and more compromise. And I think under our current system, you know, there's not a whole lot of incentives for that. But with the proportional representation system, you'd almost have to, just to form like a, you know, you wouldn't have a majority probably. Most parties would not be popular enough to have a straight up majority. So they would be forced to get anything done. They'd have to work with people, you know, outside of their given party. And I think that would be, you know, good for breaking the two-party system, good for allowing people's views to be accurately reflected in the Senate. And I think the reason I would say do the Senate that way, kind of, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, Austin, I know you mentioned the 17th Amendment and kind of how the Senate used to be almost like more the deliberative body, you know, not quite as subject to like the individual populist whims of the people. And I think that would be kind of just like a again, because you wouldn't be voting for specific candidates. You'd just be voting for a party. And I think that could maybe like almost give them more kind of autonomy a little bit to like not be as concerned about re-election necessarily. I think it could potentially have positive effects in taking away some of the effects of, you know, money in politics and some of the lobbying, because they would be accountable basically to the political party. If the political party says you're voting, you know, in a way that's not what our voters want, then they're just not going to run you as a candidate. So under the proportional representation system, political parties have a lot of power to decide who they're going to run, but you also have a lot of choices. So if a particular political party is running candidates you don't like, there's usually one that's going to be fairly ideological similar, maybe just a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right of you. But instead of having two, you maybe have like six to choose from. So it's just a wider spectrum. And I think that that could have some positive effects. And in my kind of hypothetical scenario I'm working through in my head, I would say maybe you leave the House of Representatives. I think you definitely would want to like reform gerrymandering, and you'd want to make that outlawed. You wouldn't want, yeah, you know, that distorts things a lot. But if you could fix the gerrymandering problem, I kind of like the idea of like you have a personal congressman you elect that represents your district, your interest specifically in Washington, whereas, you know, this proportional senator would represent more your political ideals, but not really be accountable to you specifically, more just the party. Whereas you'd, I like that, you know, you'd maybe have like a congress member that would represent, you know, for us in North Dakota, we'd have somebody representing us, our interests, you know, kind of like how that is currently set up. I wouldn't make a whole lot of changes besides, you know, you'd want to make some rules against gerrymandering. And if you, ideally with that, you'd implement like a ranked choice type voting. I'd like to see that too, where instead of just kind of the whoever wins a plurality, like I was saying earlier, if you win 48%, but that's more than anyone else, you win. In a ranked choice voting, it would have to be, it's whoever can get over a majority, but it's like, if you have third parties, you can vote third party, and if nobody gets a majority, they go to your, you know, you mark down like 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, however many candidates, you list out your order of preference. So if no candidates can straight up get over 50%, they look at, okay, who had the lowest, we'll wipe their votes off. Who did they put as their second choice? And then we allocate those votes. And then you say, okay, does anyone have a majority yet? No. And you kind of keep going until somebody actually can get over 50%. So you don't get this stuck in this like plurality where it's not super popular, but the third parties are stealing votes. It ranked choice voting is another idea and another way to try to reduce the problem of wasting your vote on a third party. Because in our current system, they call it first past the post, just whoever gets the most wins. If you vote third party on Congress or Senate or president, you are just wasting your vote due to the structure of it. And I mean, if that's what you think, I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I voted third party in 2016, full disclosure, but I mean, it is, it's like your vote doesn't really matter. Whereas in a ranked choice voting, say if you wanted to vote, you kind of like the libertarian congressman running, say in North Dakota, but you don't think he's going to win. You don't have to be afraid of that in a ranked choice system. So you could vote for the libertarian candidate, put your second choice, maybe a Republican, put your second choice as a Republican. And if the votes are split 40, 30, 30, and then, you know, maybe the Democrat has 40, but the more right side of the ideological spectrum, libertarians and Republicans split the vote each and only get 30. Well, in the current system, the Democrat would win. In a ranked choice system, they'd look at the libertarians and they'd say, okay, well, we'll allocate their votes. Who's their second choice? And if they picked, you know, the Republican choice, then their votes would just get allocated and the Republican would win because that's the more common ideology. So hopefully that makes sense. Hopefully I'm explaining it clearly. I'm kind of feel like I'm rambling a little bit, but I would like to see a ranked choice system for the House, but I like the individual accountability of specific districts representing specific regions without the gerrymandering. But the Senate, I would like to see maybe move to something like that. That's kind of the system that I'm kind of ideal system in my opinion. What are your initial thoughts or potential problems or benefits that you guys would see from that?
I'm very interested in something like that, just because it seems like it has the potential to break up the monotony of the two-party system and kind of get more compromise and maybe more legislation put through.
Yeah, I would say to that same point, my only request would be, if we're doing ranked choice voting, to do like the you can't just write 1, 2, 3, 4. They should do like a critical thinking or critical reading thing where it's like 1 is a triangle, 2 is a circle,
3 is a square and 4 is a whatever. And then see if people are smart enough to do that. Yeah, octagon maybe. But no, in all seriousness, I actually do. I think the idea is pretty good. I find myself wondering often like why we don't do things more like the Europeans when it comes to like the structure of legislation. I will say, like, I think that the U.S. lags behind the world in a, like, pretty, like, breakneck speed, it seems, in, like, legislation. It seems like most of the world is more liberal. And again, I wonder if that's a result of the system, where it's, like, the product is kind of just what you make it, or what you how you craft the system is really what you're going to end up representing. But, yeah, no, I definitely think that the idea is certainly an interesting one. I don't have a lot of like opposition to it right away. If we're talking about political expediency, it's a very
I'm sure you need a constitutional amendment.
Quite the climb,
it's,
yeah.
It's really sort of just a fantasy land,
but... which is unfortunate. I think that we go a lot of these conversations and we don't do the service to like lobbying and the effect money has on politics. I think you did mention it once, but like truly, I think that that's. The current system, I don't think, will be brought down easily. And I think that's a lot of it is not even just like pure sheer force of will on any one individual's part or a group. I think it's money. I think a whole structure is built towards.
The tricky part about getting it passed would be the two-party system. They're the two parties in power, and they kind of like it because there's not much competition. I mean, you know, there's only one other competitor, whereas if there's proportional, they'd maybe have five other people competing with them. And I think there's definitely like an incentive to keep the system that keeps you in relative either power or at least like the lone opposition. There's not, I don't know. I think there's something to be said for that too.
Well, there's an interesting opposition up that same lane about how Mitch McConnell now is kind of giving up on Trump and saying we're not like bringing any White House deal to the floor at all. Did you hear about that?
Oh yeah.
Just kind of towing the line.
Comments like that, yeah.
And he basically like, he wants to keep the leadership, even if he's in the majority or in the minority, excuse me, after November. He just wants to protect the Senate, you know, protect his party in the election. And I think it's a lesson certainly that should have been learned by now. If you haven't, you haven't been paying attention. Like politics is, it seems like it's driven by money and driven by power. And it attracts some really like scumbag people. It seems like, it just seems like the profession is really not, and I'm not saying all politicians certainly are. That's not what I'm saying. It's just more of like they have a predilection towards it seems, where it's just like, you guys are kind of skeevy sometimes, most of the time.
Yeah. Just like how most like highly successful people who make millions and billions have a tendency to be like almost like psychopaths and like narcissists.
It is very interesting. But I mean, yeah, circling back to the whole Senate thing, I think it's a great idea. Proportional representation, like I'm not opposed to it in the slightest.
Do you see any problems with it? Anything you don't like? I mean, obviously it would like the Senate based on like each state gets 2 votes. I mean, that would not be a thing anymore. So you would, but I think in my mind, you'd keep that regional representation in the House, which I think is important if somebody
just
like,
remember though, like, but that's one person to California's 90 or whatever it is. So like,
yeah, but also there's a state millions based... more people in California. So, I mean, you could make the case like, do we deserve
but once
equal
again,
representation
that's...
as California?
Well, like, see, and that's maybe you just drilled home a point actually that like I think brings me back to maybe I'm against more than what you're recommending, because like, yes, I do think there is a space for that. That will quickly create disdain. Like, I already do not like California, and like California probably doesn't really like Louisiana that much. I mean, that's where they're forking all of their federal, like that's what happens. Like the federal government is basically a big like wealth transfer from state to state. And it is. It's those wealthy states paying for a lot of the poor states. But, like, maybe I'm a privileged North Dakotan to say this. But, like, truly, I have a great deal of disdain for, like, not personal disdain, just, like, disdain for policy. The way that they operate their states, I just disagree with in general. Like, I don't – every state should have the way to operate, I think, how they want. I just do. I think, like, a huge exodus from California is happening for a reason right now. I don't think it's, like, a great place to be. And that's where I do think that the whims of like, just because you have so many people, why does that overshadow? Like, shouldn't we all kind of have a voice in the system? And that's where I think that like, why
but
can't you do?
Here's the other thing though. I mean, we view, California as this big blue state and they're all liberals, but you know, there's obviously millions of people in California, and there's millions of Republicans.
Absolutely.
Conservative. I mean, we'll even say conservative. There's millions of people who are not.
But that's also.
Don't agree with that. That would vote, you know, in a proportional system. Obviously, their votes get completely, they're irrelevant because they're a heavy Democratic state. But in a proportional system, those millions of people living in California that are not like super liberal, super Democrat, like their votes would actually count.
But hear me out. You could do that with literal, you could do that right now, basically. And what I'm saying is repeal the 17th Amendment. Once again, we're right back to where we started because we know these states as deep blue or only red states. Because we let the Senate our popular elections. That's like an argument. If the state, if like you just said, if it's true that California is, let's say like, let's say somehow they're 70-30%, 70 Democrat, 30 Republican. That should reflect, hopefully, right, in their state legislature, hypothetically. Their state legislature should then send people where 70% of Democrats can agree. And if that's the threshold, if they have it, then they are. They're truly sending. But very few states actually have that. And far more states are dominated by two Republican senators or two Democrat senators than I think is actually like, do you know what I mean? So while I'm kind of agreeing with still proportional representation, I think it's an awesome idea. An easier way to protect that is literally just, again, revoke the 17th Amendment. If you have state legislatures being forced to agree, now you don't just have like the popular vote. If there's, let's say, if there's 9 million registered Democrats and 8 million registered Republicans, it's constantly just the majority winning. Well, if you're electing state legislatures that also reflect that number, you should hopefully get some moderate swing in your senators that are given up to the Senate.
But do you think that would happen? I mean, I feel like that's a little wishful thinking. Don't you think that if let's just say Wisconsin or some kind of swing state, if Republicans were able to get the state legislature of Wisconsin, even barely, like 51-49, do you think they're going to be sympathetic and be like, oh, we'll put forward, we're willing to send a Democrat or a moderate?
Well, no, but
I think they're going to put forward who they think is going to be.
But look at what you just did, though. Look at what you just did. The way if you repeal the 17th Amendment, now that senator, maybe if they're popularly elected and they just made that, you know, let's just say they made a dumb move or whatever, and they're just willing to, yep, ram, we're down ticketing Republican because we barely scraped through the legislature. Your state legislature, both the Senate and the House, those people in most states are represented every 2 years. Like, or, you know what I mean? They have very similar structures to the federal government. You have a way closer to home solution, I think. And then now, those senators, by the way, the people that are, or the elected senators from your state representatives, how it used to be, so before the 17th Amendment, those people are still up every 6 years. So there's like this never-ending churning cycle of, no, we're going to replace the legislatures that's just nominated this nut whack bar. What the heck? Who is this guy? And then we'll switch it after 6 years of that, or maybe in the next, you know what I mean? Maybe in their next senator cycle, because no state has both senators up 1 year. You know what I mean? They're always on a cycle. That's where again, I just see such flourishing of like these arguments. Again, political expediency.
Yeah. And, you know, like.
Do you agree at all?
Yeah. Oh, I see your point.
Like, it's a really cool mechanic that brings it closer to home almost.
You would have to end the gerrymandering on a state level. 1 million.
There was something, percent.
And I think, I don't remember, I think it was Wisconsin or Michigan. My argument is Michigan.
Nothing without it.
Yeah, and I think it was Wisconsin or Michigan a couple years ago where a Democrat, you know, if you look at the whole statewide race where it was like, you know, governorship, Democrat or Republican, I think the Democrats won the governor's mansion. So like a majority of people in the state voted for Democrats.
Sounds like Wisconsin.
I think it was Wisconsin, yeah.
Evers or whatever is the guy.
And yet somehow due to gerrymandering, although like in the same election, the Democrat won a majority of the votes for governor, but yet due to the like district gerrymandering, the Republicans won the legislature. And I think they even had like a like super majority. I think they had like 60%.
I heard 70, I thought, yeah.
It's like, that can't be right. Like that can't be the answer. Like that's just,
you've just got this. If you look at an electoral map in those, like where Madison or in Minnesota, there's Minneapolis. And it literally is just like a whole tiny little bunch crammed into the cities. And then just these massive like chunks of Republican, just massive. But chunks
it just,
of Republican.
Yeah. So it just like further distorts. It's just, yeah, you'd,
if allow that, me to briefly say, my friend, you're right. You would have to
make it representative on the state level. Maybe if Agreed. You did proportional representation you for just your state legislatures.
You know what you should just
maybe
do?
Maybe that's the fix.
You know what you should do? You should be forced to like, you should be forced to hand over, like the more red you are, you should be forced to hand over how your counties work to the blue states or something like that. It's just some weird compromise where you're forced to look each other in the eyes and like work with each other or something like that and how terrible that would be. I also did hear, I watched this really interesting Vice video about, it was actually Nancy Pelosi's daughter, maybe a journalist perhaps, but she was walking around interviewing members of Congress in 16, 18 that were leaving Congress. I think it was 18. When did Paul Ryan leave? 2018?
I think 18.
Okay.
I think
so. It was 2018. And this video said one of the biggest reasons that these senators, the people that worked in Washington said that were now like this is because Newt Gingrich, apparently, back in the 90s, took away, like, these people used to, like, live in Washington. They used to, like, dorm. They used to have dormitories where they'd have to, like, all 100 senators, it would obviously be, I don't understand, probably not co-ed, but you know what I mean? Like, you would live together and you interacted. You spent most of your time in Washington, not back home campaigning, not living in your district and having some weird apartment in Virginia outside of DC somewhere. Seriously, that was how it worked. And that was what they posited as a reason for, like, we don't have dinner anymore. We don't talk. We're not friends. We're just constantly mudslinging. So again, I almost wonder how many, like, easy fixes, but yet unwilling to route fixes we have in front of us that just make these, like, grandiose claims of, grandiose changes to our system could just be, like, fixed or, like, changed just by these people not being complete jerks or, like, having some form. Again, I think we talk decorum, just like, and again, what a sad thing that, like, decorum is now some, like, offhand assumption. It's something you can't rely on anymore. It's a notion that's, like, long gone. It's just we're at each other's throats. And again, I think I talked earlier, every issue is the make or break. We're done and our way of life is over if we lose this one vote on immigration or environment, the withdrawing of the Paris Agreement or whatever it is, you know. So yeah, no, I honestly, to rewind to what we initially started this, the second or part two of the podcast, if you will, proportional representation, I am in favor of. I would really like to say that I'm in support of North Dakota and Wyoming having just as much of a voice in some form of government. There seems to be some, like, if all 50 states are treated respect, like, equals in some form, it feels like it's all of equal game. Like, it's all a fair game. Because the minute that you have, like, seriously, the way Washington works is, it's who you know. The minute that you remove, it's just proportional representation for the Senate, and you just have, like, mass numbers, like, your numbers can get more lobbies and more, like, where do contracts go? Do federal contracts just completely dry up for the states that don't have the ears or, like, the mouths to, like, speak up for their state? Do you know what I mean? Are they allowed? Because 435 people is a lot of people. Your voice drowns out quickly in that. And then you're up for election every 2 years. You're spending the first 9 months getting to know as a rookie in Washington, I'd assume. You're spending the first 9 months getting well acquainted with how everything works. You have 3 months to maybe do something. And guess what happens year two? Go back home. It's time to campaign. Hopefully you don't lose. You did just waste 2 years of your life. It just stinks. So again, rule number one, I definitely agree with you. I think proportional representation is a great idea. It's just, hopefully we can return to some sense of like, we're not at each other's throats over everything anymore. That would be awesome.
And I think one of the like benefits of proportional representation, in my mind, at least, I think it would help to reduce kind of what you're describing a little bit. It's like, I think the term is negative partisanship, where like to win elections, it's a really good tactic to like rile up your base, like by saying the other side is so evil and so bad. I mean, you look and it's just like Joe Biden's candidacy, like one of the major selling points is like, I'm not Donald Trump. Like vote for me. Like I'm not Donald Trump, which like, okay, fine. But like you look at Donald Trump and it's the same thing. Like he characterized Biden as like, oh, vote for me.
Winning argument with me.
Vote for me. And, or else you're going to get this like socialist commie who's going to like defund the, and he just like, you know, it's always just like, you try to, it's not like, oh, I'm Donald Trump. Look, vote for me. Cause I have these good ideas. It's like, vote for me because this guy's going to ruin the country. And Joe Biden, you know, it's like, And I mean, yeah, obviously if you look at their websites, they have some ideas. I'm not saying there's no ideas, but like so much of the campaigning that you hear is just like, they're evil and I like vote for me because they're evil, not vote for me because I have good ideas. And I think proportional representation, when you expand, it's not just two parties. You can't say that. You can't just say, Joe Biden can't say, oh, vote for me because I'm not Donald Trump. Because, well, I guess this maybe wouldn't work for president, but in a more multi-party system, you know, you wouldn't say, John Hovind couldn't say, oh, you know, vote for me because the Democrat is so evil, because that wouldn't work. Because if they're both crappy, then you just voted, you know, there's three other parties to choose from. So you could actually vote with one that reflects your idea. So I think in that, like, that would be one of the main benefits in my mind is if you have these two people going at it, then probably they both lose if they're both terrible candidates. Whereas like, you know, the people, it's more based on ideas than like trying to characterize your opposition as terrible.
Yeah. I think I find agreement in pretty much everything you just said. So
I guess the only thing I'm not entirely sure on in this like fantasy world that we're discussing the Electoral College, and that's obviously a controversial topic, whether, you know, how do you elect the president? Should the president be just popular vote? Should it be some form of, I don't know. To me, I don't really like the current setup of the Electoral College. It doesn't seem like it's really working right now. Now, I know, maybe, I think, Austin, we've talked off the podcast before about some sort of system, maybe where it's like more proportional, like each state gets the Electoral College, but it's more proportional based on the votes within that state, something like that. Maybe that could work. I don't know. But I think right now I'd be leaning towards the straight popular vote. And I know a lot of people don't like that. But I think part of it is that the people who don't like it are the ones who think they're benefiting from the system. And if you look at I think Republicans would be up in arms if Donald Trump won more votes and Hillary Clinton, like hypothetically, if Donald Trump had won more votes than Hillary Clinton and Clinton was in the White House. I mean, I think we mentioned the militias earlier briefly, but like, I think people would be just like in the streets. I think people would be, they would say the system is terrible. I think all these Republicans who defend now would be willing to get rid of it instantly if it went against them. And to me, that just kind of seems like it's not like, the people who like it are the ones who seem like they're benefiting from it. And I think if it were flipped, and if like sort of just that like thought experiment where like, if the tables were turned, would you still be okay with it? And I feel like some people, yeah, I'm sure there's some people who objectively like it, but I think the majority of people would really be disappointed and frustrated if their person lost due to the Electoral College when they had the more popular opinions. I don't know. So do you guys have any thoughts on Electoral College?
Anything to say over there, Mr. Lizakowski?
It's a tricky topic.
Well, I would say that, once again, let me lay maybe perhaps a more simple solution than abolishing it. Why not just do proportional representation in the Electoral College? Like, and what I'm saying is, why not do exactly Maine and Nebraska, like force every state to do it? Just every state has to. North Dakota has 3 votes. You can send 2 for Trump, 1 for Biden. Let's see if Fargo and Bismarck can produce. Sorry, that was incredibly disrespectful of me, Bismarck friends. Let's see if Fargo can vote for Biden. Yeah. No, but all seriousness, like, that's what I think. Down the line, down the ticket. Texas, like, imagine, we could just tell so easy. It should be a popular vote in the states, and we should just, like, tally up what party gets what. And this could go hat in hand, by the way, with your Senate fix. I think you could immediately, it would meld perfectly into, like, the Electoral College fix here. So Maine and Nebraska, I think, have the secret sauce.
California's like 55 electoral votes. They could divvy it up via the proportional system.
Let's see if you send 5. Because guess how many more people that's going to, like.
Would you send third party? Would that still work? Because in the presidency, that could get kind of weird. Like, proportional is useful. Like,
yeah, that's not how any European country works. You elect, like, there's no president. There's just a prime minister. It's prime minister. It's whoever, what party has the majority.
It's a little different. That's the only thing I could see it getting, like. It would be hard, like, say 5% of
California. You could still do it.
You could, but like 5% of California could vote for Joe Jorgensen, the Libertarian candidate. And I guess you could send a couple delegates to the Electoral College. Then you probably would get a lot more situations where there's not a, like, you don't hit the 270 mark.
And
you
absolutely.
You don't have a clear, which would, I don't
but
know.
But that, I think that's like, I think, interesting, again, I think
then it would go to the, is it the House that picks the president? Yep. So I don't know. Yeah, it'd be.
That's a genius thing, by the way.
It'd be kind of interesting, but I don't know if that'd be good or not. Maybe it'd be okay. Just like, I could see that being kind of potentially weird, as if you get third candidates, which, I mean, I like third party.
I mean,
candidates,
if the whole,
but
yeah,
it could just make
whole,
it weird if nobody gets a majority in the Electoral College, then it's like you get just the House picking. I don't know. Maybe
well,
that's not
maybe
bad.
You don't know. Maybe you just don't defer to the House unless it's like a tie, unless it's just like a straight up tie between the two. You just go with whoever got the most. Like plurality kind of style. That's how Europeans, like I said, I think we can meet somewhere halfway. And I do think the president, by the way, having the independence of like the executive from the legislative, I think that that's good. I don't know how the European like
the
checks and balances
model.
Work there, but yeah. I do. I support fully the, because how kind of crappy would it be to be like, oh yeah, Boris Johnson is on the world stage for us. And I didn't even like, he represents like a downtown, like Manchester, like borough or whatever it is. I'm misquoting, but, and I'm terribly ignorant when it comes to, like, where he runs for.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. That would be weird, and I don't like that.
Yeah. Like, you mean if Paul Ryan or Nancy Pelosi was just, like, running the entire country?
He was, like, on the world stage, and, like, Paul Ryan represents Wisconsin somewhere. It's like, what is going on here?
Yeah, I agree. I do like the presidential system. I mean, there's obviously...
But look, we would be mixing. But... We would be mixing parliamentary features. It would be... what would it be? What does China call it? Chinese socialism. Or socialism with Chinese characteristics. So this would be, what would it be? Direct democracy with American characteristics, where it's just a little bit of still a lie. You're not still voting that necessarily direct, but yeah.
I think there's definitely a lot of...
I think it's a good solution.
There's a lot of things to look into for sure. And like, I'd be open to a lot of these like reforms. I don't know. Like, I don't think the current setup works. Like, are you guys okay with the current system? Because it just seems like it's not good. Like, two times in the last 20 years where it doesn't reflect the popular vote, like, that... It worked for a long time, and it just kind of lined up, and, like, fine. So it, like, just worked. Nobody really complains. But
I will say, I don't think we're going to see it again.
The only way Donald Trump's going to win again is via the electoral... Like, if he somehow wins, he's not winning the popular vote.
I don't think we're going to see it again for a long time. I think that we've had... I'm not going to say... Now, listen, the reason I think my argument here has authenticity is because I'm not using it as a reason to say no to your suggestions, right? I'm just using it kind of as, like, a passive observation. I don't think it's going to happen that frequently again. I think we had like two situations where like the stars aligned. Do you know how close we were to having like Utah go purple with Evan McMillan or whatever that gentleman's name was? It was close. Like Hillary beat him in Utah, but still it was like he garnered not a plurality, but you know what I'm saying? Remember that like perfect like, oh, it ties at 269 because Evan wins Utah or some like concoction? That was a not unheard of scenario. And I'm just saying... It's like literally like blindfolding yourself and I think playing darts night after night at the bar and like you land, you know, let's say in 20 years you land two bullseyes blindfolded. I do. I think it's like that. No, I could swallow my words in 2 years and hopefully we still have this podcast to do it, right? But I am saying like truth – or 4 years, sorry. I do think it would be like I am okay with getting rid of it, right? Like I'm okay with modernizing and reforming it totally. So that's where I think like my argument is more of just like – or no, it is – it's not an argument. It's just a passive observation where it's like – I don't know how often that's going to happen. It's not some destiny that now, oh, we've reached 2020, or I'm so sorry, we reached the year 2000, and now somehow every other year Republicans are going to win, not the popular vote, though. I think that we will have a Republican president sometime in our lifetime that genuinely wins the Electoral College and the popular vote if it's not reformed. I do think that we'll have a return to some. Yeah, I don't think it's unheard of. But again, I think the Democrats will have it a lot sooner. I think Joe Biden is going to very swiftly win. And it is. It's kind of weird how, like, oh, if Ohio just slightly tips 51-49, Trump could win. So that's where, again, I'm not using it as an argument to say no. It's just kind of a passive observation. Darn, the last two feel like flukes almost. Like, I don't feel like that's the future, inevitably. I could be wrong, but just an observation. On that note, is there anything else to say? I think that's, at least for me, I'm fully on board. I think we're kind of watching things unfold. Probably the next podcast will probably land on pretty close to Election Day, if not like after Election Day, maybe. So we'll be counting down the days. I think there's only like, what, 14, 21, something like 2-3 weeks.
Coming up quick.
It's rapidly approaching. Yeah. What is it? Is it the 16th today? 17th? 17th. Yeah. So, wow. Dang. Like 2 weeks and maybe some 2 weeks and a two and couple change. Days. Yep. Very good. Well, again, this has been Rediscovering Liberalism, episode number 4. Kind of the continuation of talking about Senate structural reform. Again, I'm sure we will have much more kind of like fodder for conversation, seeing how Lindsey Graham and company operates with the rest of Barrett's nomination, and maybe seeing a little bit as to what I heard that Mr. Joseph Biden has promised me his position on court packing, but only after the 2020 election. So once I'm entitled to his opinion on that, which I thought was a laughable comment, absolutely through and through, once I'm entitled to his opinion on that, maybe we'll have more to talk about then too, about court packing and maybe what that looks like. Again, big changes possibly happening as kind of like a strike back from Democrats in the coming, let's say, coming year. And we'll see kind of how that shapes up. So again, thank you for checking out Rediscovering Liberalism. We do have a Facebook, Twitter, and maybe Instagram. We're hobbling between that, but Facebook and Twitter right now, we will have that up and active by the time this episode releases. So go and check us out. We'll hopefully have the streaming schedule up then or some semblance of it. And then you can